Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Over 17 seasons in the major leagues, pitcher David Cone experienced the highest highs and the lowest lows. The five-time All-Star won the 1994 Cy Young Award, earned five World Series rings, four with the Yankees dynasty of the 90s, and threw the 16th perfect game in 1999.
Popped up and playable! Gracious!
He also endured multiple surgeries, including for a life-threatening aneurysm, sometimes lost his confidence, and never stopped tinkering as he thought about how to get the next batter out. Cone was also known as a clubhouse leader and built a good rapport with the baseball writers, including Jack Curry. Curry spent 20 years at the New York Times before joining the Yes Network in 2010. Their new book is called Full Count: The Education of a Pitcher. Jack Curry and David Cone, welcome to the roundtable.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
Yeah, thank you, Ian.
Let's start with you, Jack. As a reporter covering David Cone, what made him the pitcher he was? What made him interesting to watch?
His creativity, his passion, the fact that you could see his mind working on the mound. When I approached David about trying to do this book a few years ago, I said to him, I would love to write a book where we can get inside the mind of a pitcher. And David was the top choice for me because of some of the things that I just mentioned. I felt as if when you watched him, you could see that the wheels were always turning. And then when you interviewed him after the game, he filled up your notebook. He would go pitch by pitch with you. He would go inning by inning with you. And I felt that if we could collaborate and bring some of that to the reader, some of that, what's it like to be on the mound? And it's a 3-2 full count, which is part of the reason why we chose that name. And you're not sure if you should throw your slider or your splitter or your fastball. And if we could do that, I felt that it would be a successful book. And I think we did accomplish that.
In your experience, is that kind of openness and willingness to analyze a game pitch by pitch unusual in the Major League Clubhouse?
I would say this, that David stood out in that arena. I've interviewed a lot of other intelligent pitchers, and we quote a lot of them in the book. For this book, I interviewed Greg Maddux and Tom Glavin and Mariano Rivera and Andy Pettit. But I always felt that David had a soft spot for the journalist. And you read the book, Ian, you saw the part that he actually grew up wanting to be a sports writer. And I think when the game was over, he wanted to share his experiences with us. And I've covered baseball for almost 30 years now. And David, whenever I'm asked who did you enjoy interviewing the most, I always say David Cone, because he understood what we were trying to do with our questions, and he didn't mind sharing his knowledge. And not only did he share his knowledge with me when I covered him throughout his career, but with this book, I actually feel that he's made me better at my job at Yes because of all the pitching knowledge that he shared as we were working on this book.
David Cone, did you have any reticence about sharing some of the secrets of the trade?
No, not really. You know, I think I'm far enough removed from pitching. Not a distant memory at this point, but it's certainly something that's in my past. So I think part of the reason I wanted to do it was Jack Curry, and I know known Jack for a long time, and I know how inquisitive he is, how real he is, and there was just a comfort level for me working with Jack, and I think he did a tremendous job of putting everything together Getting things out of me that I wouldn't have normally probably thought about because of our relationship over the years.
I want to go back in time a bit, and one person who figures in a major way in your story is your first pitching coach, your dad. And he was able to teach you how to really approach pitching in a serious manner. And I was wondering where his knowledge of pitching and the game of baseball came from.
He was a fanatic baseball fan. He was an amateur pitcher as well in the Kansas City area where we grew up. And he just had such a passion for knowledge, voracious reader. He just could not get enough of information and being a fan and going to the games. And, you know, he worked also the graveyard shift at a meatpacking plant in Kansas City, in the Kansas City area. And it was a great impact on me, you know, when he would you would get home from work and maybe take a couple of hours of a nap and then get up and be ready to coach, be ready to go to practice. He was my little league coach in basketball and football and also baseball. But there was something about baseball that we both just seemed to gravitate towards. And when the Royals were having those great runs in the 70s and playing the Yankees, that was right in my sweet spot of going through high school, you know, the latter parts of elementary school and high school. And, you know, that just kind of enhanced everything for us.
When and how did you realize that you might have a legit shot at the big leagues? Because, you know, you were signed out of high school and things happened in a hurry, but of course there's no overnight success.
No, there's not. You know, it took me a while. You know, I had a major knee injury my second year of the minor leagues. So it was quite a bit of a setback. So there were times throughout my minor league career where I wasn't sure if I would even get one day in the big leagues. And that was kind of a goal. Just to say that I made it would be a huge success after all the years in the minor leagues and the injuries that I went through. So, yeah, there's a lot of doubt along the way. So I wasn't really sure until I finally made it, to tell you the truth. There was a time in winter ball, I guess, when, you know, I went to play in Puerto Rico a couple of years in the mid-'80s, 85 and 86, when I thought I was getting close. There was a chance I was at least going to break through it and, you know, make a debut on a major league roster.
I'll direct this next question for Jack Curry. When you were reporting this book, how much did it set in that baseball has changed a lot since David Cone's era? And, you know, I'm thinking about pitch counts and throwing over the winter and, you know, even down to something as simple as replay.
100%, Ian. David talked about this, and he talks about this on the Yes broadcasts. Sometimes David would have 100 pitches through five innings, but he knew he had the liberty to throw 130, so he might get to the seventh or the eighth inning. He had some time to work with, and sometimes he wanted to pitch around a guy. Sometimes he wanted to pitch around the number seven guy in the order because he thought he could get the number eight batter, and obviously if the pitcher was hitting ninth in the National League. So we definitely talked about that. David had starts where he threw 160-something pitches and wanted to be out there. He came up in a time where you were looked down upon if you started peeking towards the dugout or the bullpen as you approached 100 pitches. There were veterans who basically bullied and hazed young pitchers. And, come on, what are you doing in the trainer's room? You should be out there, and your goal should be to finish the game. We know, Ian, that that doesn't exist anymore. Teams value those pitchers' arms, and the idea of a complete game is very rare these days. I believe last year that the highest average per start was something in the low 100s for a starter. I mean, David, before he got traded from the Mets to the Blue Jays, had a run of about 10 starts where he averaged close to 140 pitches a game. So that has definitely changed. I think umpiring has changed with the fact that these umpires are graded more closely. It's a little more difficult for pitchers to get pitches on the corners. So we absolutely discussed that. And then you look at things along the ways of how pitchers can be better these days. David would have absolutely been someone who embraced the idea of using high-speed cameras to see what his spin rate was and maybe make his curve or his slider even better. So we were absolutely cognizant of the fact that we were writing a book about pitching, but that things have changed in the close to 15 or 16 years since David last pitched in the majors.
And for David, you know, anyone who watches your work on the Yes Network knows that you are current on the literature in baseball. You embrace sabermetrics and you like the analytics. And I had to wonder, you know, how would that have played out in your career as a pitcher if you had access to the amount of information that there is today for every single matchup, you know, day, night, lefty, righty, you name it?
Yeah, I sort of split it into two different categories. You know, all of the information or the sabermetric side is different than the analytics side for me. The analytics side is more of the high-speed cameras, some of the tools that are used to develop pitches or pitch design, as Jack said. That's something that I would really have loved to have had, you know, when I pitched. The numbers part, you know, what you mentioned as far as the matchups or anything on the sabermetric side, I think is something I would have definitely been interested in, but sometimes that can too much information can bog down a player. hitters and pitchers need to have a free mind when they're in the middle of a competition. So some players could handle that information, some can't. So you know, you have to be careful on that side of it. But nonetheless, I appreciate the talent today. I'm not one of those old school pitchers that says, you know, the current pitchers are soft or they need to throw more. You know, I actually agree with some of the pitch counts. And I also know that the talent level in the bullpens nowadays has never been greater, in my opinion. I think we're in the era of the best relief pitching we've ever seen in the history of the game. And, you know, if you go back to the 1980s, I think there was a big drop-off from the starting rotations to the middle relievers. And then maybe the closers, you had some great closers back then, but, you know, the middle relievers weren't on par with what they have today. So, you know, I think that impacts the game, and rightly so. So, I sort of embrace the modern style and understand it, even though I was, viewed as a workhorse or a guy who probably threw a lot of pitches.
Since you've raised the bullpen, I want to ask you about some specific moments in your career, and one that is just indelible came in the Subway Series in 2000. You hadn't had a great year, and you were thinking you might be left off the postseason roster. There's so much drama because the Yankees end up facing the Mets, two teams on which you had most of your success in some huge years. And you end up coming out of the bullpen to face Mike Piazza in a pivotal moment. How did your mindset change from being used to being a starter to coming out in what we would now call a high leverage situation like that?
My mindset really kind of went back to my minor league days, when I actually had a little bit of experience in the bullpen. I was actually a closer at one point and with the Royals in AAA. So I had had some experience, and to me that was pretty easy to go back and kind of get into that mindset. I would just pitch from the stretch position like a lot of relievers do, and I would concentrate on certain matchups. And I knew with regard to the Mets that my matchup was going to be Mike Piazza. So I basically sat in the bullpen and thought about ways to get Mike Piazza out because I knew that would be the key matchup, if at all. And thankfully, Joe Torre found me a spot because it was the only chance I had to pitch in that series, and it was obviously my last appearance as a Yankee as well.
1-2 delivery, fastball popped up, second base. Soho, and it has worked for now. He comes on in a one-run ball game, and did you see Don Zimmer just give it the big and let out a big rush?
We're talking with David Cohn and Jack Curry about their new book, Full Count, The Education of a Pitcher. Let me go back to 1996. Game 3 of the World Series comes around. The Braves have dominated the Yankees in the first two games. You're coming back off an aneurysm, and you have a very pivotal mound meeting with Joe Torre, arguing to stick around. Can you take us through that series and that relationship you had with manager Joe Torre?
The 96 team in the first year of Joe Torre had a lot of adversity. You know, Joe Torre himself had two brothers, one Rocco that he lost, passed away during the season, and then another one, Frank Torre, that had a heart transplant during the World Series. So there was a lot of drama off the field that really brought that team closer together, more so than any other team I've ever been a part of. We really cared about each other. We really liked each other. And, to get to the World Series was quite an experience because it was Joe Torre's first time at being in a World Series. After all the years as a player and a manager and a broadcaster, he had never gotten a chance to participate in a World Series. So to me, that was kind of the theme. But then, you know, the Braves were a great team in 1996 on the heels of winning it in 95. And they blew us out the first two games at home at Yankee Stadium. And we weren't even competitive, to be honest. And so that put a lot of pressure on game 3. And also a lot of pride was at stake. We felt like we were embarrassed as a team. And we felt like the media and the Braves were acting like what was going to be their place in history as a dynasty team. And we were just kind of along for the ride as the Yankees participated in that World Series. So I think we had a lot of emotion as a team going into Game 3. I know I did. I was very vocal with my teammates about that we needed to show some pride and, you know, and make this competitive and show them that we're not just a prop in this World Series. So, you know, I think game three was huge in that regard. We got back into the series. We felt like, you know, that we had redeemed ourselves a little bit with that game three win, and it gave us a lot of confidence from that point on. As far as the meeting with Joe Torre on the mound, you know, it was a gutsy performance. You know, I was okay. I wasn't necessarily on top of my game. I was pitching very carefully, a lot of deep counts, a lot of tough at-bats, a couple of jams that I had to pitch out of. And one of those jams was, you know, when Joe Torre came out in the mound to talk to me and ask me if I was okay. And, you know, naturally as a pitcher, I just kind of looked at the ground and said, yeah, I'm fine. And he kept inching closer to me and he kept repeating, no, this is too important. I need to know that you're okay. And he finally got almost nose to nose with me and made me look him in the eyes. And I never had a manager do that to me on the mound during a game. And he almost grabbed me and pulled me close and implored me. I think I used the word implore back then. He implored me to tell him the truth that I was okay. And so I had to look him in the eye and reassure him that, you know, that I still had confidence and physically I was still okay and that I still wanted to be in that game.
Joe Torre saying that David Cone will tell him the truth. You remember earlier in the ALCS against Baltimore, Cone had a long day. Joe Torre went out and Cone convinced him that he could stay in and get one more hitter. He was right.
And it's something you note in the book that Joe Torre was a big believer in the heartbeat of the game. You know, the stats are important and the scouting report is important, but he seemed to have a real genius for, you know, dealing with people and their emotions.
Well, he did. You know, he commanded respect. To me, that's the difference between some managers will come in and try to demand respect. And Joe Torre didn't demand it. He commanded it because he had instant credibility. People understood what type of experience he had. He was a great player. He was a manager for a lot of years. He was a broadcaster. He encompassed a lot of skills that we picked up on early. And he dealt with George Steinbrenner probably as well as anybody. He got in front of a lot of issues that in the past would have become distractions for Yankee teams because of the owner. And that really never happened with Joe Torre. And I'm not sure he's ever gotten enough credit for that. I know a lot of people talk about it. But it was a huge asset to have a manager that was the manager of the New York Yankees that could manage George Steinbrenner the way he did and keep him sort of be a buffer between the players and the ownership.
I'll put this question to both of you, David first, then Jack. No one's repeated as a World Series champion since the Yankees ran off 4 and 5 years. So what was the secret to, you know, climbing the mountain and then finding a way to stay up there?
Jack, you want to go first? Or?
That's a great question, Ian. And when you were covering those teams, as I was back then, I was writing for the New York Times, you knew you were covering something special. And I actually think that in 97, the Yankees thought they could have won it that year, too. So when you think about the fact that they lost to Cleveland and they thought that their team was good enough to win it, I mean, imagine if they could have reeled off 5 in a row. But I mean, it always starts with talent. We're going to talk about chemistry, and we're going to talk about guys knowing their roles. But those teams had some serious veteran talent, and you had the young guys coming up. You had some smart decision makers in the Yankee front office who were able to add Jeter, Pettit, Rivera. Posada came a little bit later. I mean, he didn't really contribute to that 96 team. But I think when you combine that with having a David Cone in the rotation and O'Neill and Tino Martinez. I mean, to me, it starts with talent and then it's knowing your role and it's those teams gelling and it's things going your way. I mean, the postseason can be a situation where one ball bounces in the wrong direction and suddenly you're down in a series and you end up losing it. But I just think it was that mixture of factors that made those teams so special.
You know, I think those teams were the overall depth of those teams were the key. Guys like Daryl Strawberry and Tim Raines coming off the bench, not only being productive players off the bench, but being leaders and accepting of their roles. It was the perfect storm of an entire roster, 1 through 25, really contributing to the most. You know, those rosters were the deepest teams I've ever been a part of. You know, I make the argument that the 98 team was the best team, 1 through 25, the entire roster, the deepest team of any team ever in the history of the game. I don't say our starting nine was as good as the 27 Yankees or the big red machine of the 70s or any team you want to throw out there that you think might be the greatest or in that argument. But 1 through 25 with Mariano Rivera as the closer to be was the key. And I often joke with Glavin and Maddox when I see him in Smoltz that if they would have had Mariano Rivera at the end of the games, then they would probably be the ones with the multiple rings. So I really think Mariano at the end and the entire depth of the roster was what separated those teams.
Okay, well, I have to ask about the perfect game you threw. The 20th anniversary is coming up this year. Interesting to note that you had not watched a replay of the game until very recently. What did that mean to you? I mean, you've had a lot of individual success, won a Cy Young, you know, you were constantly playing in the World Series. And then you have this kind of fluke day where everything's just working right for you.
Yeah, it's the further removed I get from that day, the more I appreciate all of the nuances that came into play. It was Yogi Berra Day. I remember warming up before that game and watching Yogi, and there was such a happiness in the ballpark that Yogi Berra was back, and he was riding around in a convertible car around the outfield track, and the reaction of the fans to him and Carmen, his wife, were just remarkable. And I don't even remember warming up. It was a really hot day. I threw some pitches. My arm was loose, but I was more interested in enjoying Yogi, really caught up in the emotion of the day. But it turned out to be a nice distraction for me, kind of carefree. My mind was free. I was very relaxed. I didn't have a worry in the world. I was facing a team, the Montreal Expos, that had a lineup full of players who had never faced me, not even one at bat. The entire lineup, there was no experience, so I kind of felt like I had an advantage there. I think the pitcher always has an advantage when there's no history. And then I also realized that, Don Larsen threw out the first pitch. Yogi Berra used Joe Girardi's glove to catch that first pitch. I had a little interaction with Don before the game, and I asked him if he was going to jump into Yogi's arms again, and I got it completely wrong, and Larsen kind of barked at me and said, "It's the other way around, kid. He jumped into my arms." And so there was a little bit of humor there, and I felt, kind of sheepish that I'd gotten history wrong. And then as the game unfolded, even with a rain delay in the fourth inning, I believe, it wasn't too long. It was only maybe a half hour or 45 minutes in the rain delay, so it didn't really impact me. And in fact, it kind of helped me. On a really hot day, Joe Girardi has told me that my stuff got better after the rain delay. Sometimes that happens. You can kind of relax a little bit and catch your breath. My rhythm was a little better after the rain delay. And then at the end of the game, I end up throwing 88 pitches on Yogi Berra Day, whose number was 8. And there was a big number 8 painted behind the home plate in the grass. So all of the nuances, all of the, the mystical baseball lore stuff was all in play. And, I'm still stunned to this day that when I think about all of those things, and when I tell this story, that people hear for the first time that I threw 88 pitches, in a complete game, perfect game. I used to throw 88 pitches in 4 innings, a lot of games. So it's just remarkable when you think about, everything that happened that day.
You say in the book that at 7:05 p.m. you had something sort of kick in your mind even after you had retired from the game, and it took a while before you found that purpose again. Are you interested in becoming a pitching coach?
I would never say never. I've been asked a couple of times to interview for pitching coach jobs, but I just wasn't prepared to do it at that point. You have to be ready to be fully immersed and, go live the life that I lived for those 17 years. And that's something I just really haven't been prepared to commit to as of yet. You never say never. So, I wouldn't rule it out.
Jack, would Coney make a good pitching coach?
Absolutely. If you listen to the Yankee games on Yes, there are times where he is saying things that a pitching coach would say. And I think he points that out in the book that as a pitcher, you're probably going to make 32 or 33 starts a year. So when David was playing, he needed something to do for those 130 games. So he became a coach in the dugout, so to speak, and he learned that from Ron Darling and Bob Ojeda. Watch what's going on the field. Maybe you see something that you could pass on to your teammates, and I absolutely think that he would make a terrific pitching coach. But I'm not going to plan out his life for him. We like him very much at Yes, Ian, so I don't want him to leave.
Okay, last question for you. I just want your opinion on this debate over the state of baseball, you know, the length of games, the new rules that are moving in terms of a pitcher having to face three batters. Is this something that needs to happen? And what would you like to see? David, then Jack.
Yeah, Ian, I think it's worthwhile to talk about structural changes to the game. I'm a little reluctant to implement them all at once. You know, the pace of play, I think there's so many variables involved, and not the least of which is 2 minutes and 20 seconds in between innings for commercial breaks. I think you can probably look at those as being a major contributor to the length of the games. There is just, you know, it's hard to change the structure of the game because it's changed so much. Even 50 years ago, pitchers weren't as strikeout conscious. There was more of a pitch to a contact mentality. So I think the style of the game has just changed, and that has an impact on the time of the game. And that's going to be something that's hard to unravel. I mean, you're talking about extreme talent level and extreme velocity now in the game. Every bullpen in the major leagues has two or three guys that throw 95 to 100 miles an hour now, and more in the minor league pipeline coming. So yeah, it's going to be a very difficult thing to try to implement some of these changes, even though I think some of them are worthwhile to talk about, but I'd be reluctant to implement them without further studies.
And Jack?
I echo a lot of what David said, Ian. I think subtle changes or considerations to make changes, that's always a smart thing. Look, they got rid of the idea of you had to throw the four balls outside the strike zone for an intentional walk, and they just have the batter go to first now, and we don't hear a word about it. They've limited the amount of visits to the mound, and we don't hear anything about that. But I would be careful on doing things along the lines. I'm not a fan of the three-batter relief rule. I know David and I talked about this during a spring training game a little bit. I don't like the idea that if a pitcher is brought in and after two batters, it's clear, absolutely clear, that he is not your best pitcher to help you win the game that day. And then that guy gives up a three-run homer because you're handcuffed and you can't bring in another pitcher. I actually have a problem with that. I don't think in the NBA or the NFL they would keep a guy on the bench until the next whistle. So that one, I'm curious to see if that actually gets enacted. And I always think the pace of play stuff is interesting. We all want to see the game move along, but some of the greatest games, when you see postseason games and everyone's talking about this game and it advanced to extra innings and that dramatic ninth inning, no one is talking about, wow, that game lasted 3 hours and 28 minutes. It just seems as if sometimes you can be your own worst enemy focusing on whether a game ended at 2 hours and 58 minutes or 3 hours and 7 minutes.
And as far as the reliever goes, what's to stop the pitcher from saying, hey, my arm hurts after the second batter? I don't think that's been figured out yet.
It's a great question. And right, then you're going to have to say, well, are they going to enact something where if a guy leaves a game after two batters, is it an automatic injured list thing? So I think that's one where the conversations will absolutely continue.
We've been speaking with David Cohn and Jack Curry about the new book, Full Count, The Education of a Pitcher. This has just been such a pleasure for me. Jack, I'm a huge fan of your work on Yes and your writing. And David Cohn, you're my favorite pitcher ever. So this was a pretty great work day.
Oh, well, we appreciate the kind words, Ian.
Absolutely. And thanks for having us on. It's good talking to you.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.